overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Many blessings to you.
The sound of the bell reverberate throughout this universe, restoring us to sanity, inviting us into an abiding peace, and taking us into the breath, which is another word for spirit. And so this spirit that we all share, the one spirit, has never abandoned us or forsaken us. It has always been there waiting for us to return. To return to the stillness, which is the language of God. And then to invite us to deeply listen. Not listening with our ears, but more listening with our heart. Listening with that part of us that deeply connects to a field, Rumi says, out beyond the ideas of right thinking and wrong thinking, there is a field. And when the soul lies down in that field, this field of awareness, this field of love, this field of peace, he said, words are not necessary. Even the idea, each other, does not exist. And then he says, I will meet you there. And so we are meeting in what some calls the we consciousness. We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a better place. So let's start giving. On the calendar in the men's bathroom from the Nature Conservancy, in the little bottom it says, please tell your legislatures to regard our planet as sacred. And that little seed idea I read just before taking a seat up here, and I look out on the beautiful leaves that are bright gold and red, and I saw a pileated woodpecker this morning in the tree, and it took me to a place of radical stopping. So much beauty. And how often do I stop and actually look and say, wow, I live in the Garden of Eden. I live in paradise. Do I actually see it, or am I so consumed with my thoughts and concerns that I don't see the simplicity and the beauty of life that's all around us? This morning I came into the center after moving the clocks back. And I find this space to be very sacred for me. Every corner I look in, there's some remembrance. The namaste window in the classroom was made by one of our congregants because he loved the feeling of namaste when he would come here, Dal Widener. I saw the teddy bear sitting in the corner saying, well, you know, I'd rather be on the sofa. That's where I like to sit. And so I picked him up and I took him to the sofa. And all of a sudden, I'm having a conversation with my old white dog who would frequently come here and lie on the sofa, even though so many adults said, get that dog off the sofa. In my dining room, there is a photograph of Bert on a red velvet sofa, which was the sofa in Maine, which was taboo, verboten, for a white dog who sheds. And everybody would scream at Bert, "Don't get on the sofa, don't get on the sofa." And he'd waddle around, "Well, you know, I'm used to getting on the sofa." So he found his way to the sofa. And I put a little towel down. "Well, thank you. You know, I don't sit on the floor. I'm a sofa boy." And I said, "I know you are." And so I'm having a conversation with the spirit. Or maybe the spirit is having a conversation with me. And I reflect on what a sweet teacher he is still, even though he's been off the planet for 4 months now. And in his diminished capacity, and Jody remembers that so well, perhaps he was the sweetest teacher of all when he couldn't stand and I'd have to lift him up, when he couldn't climb the stairs and I'd carry him up, when he couldn't stand and eat at his bowl and I would feed him by hand, one little morsel at a time. And he was so grateful to cherish him as he would waddle to his water bowl and to try to get into his position to go to the bathroom. What grace he showed me, what humility, what devotion. And so this Sunday morning, I'm feeling the sweetness of the teachers. And we're exploring this month of November, how not to go back to sleep. Once this spirit of life awakens, Rumi says, don't go back to sleep. And what awakens is this eternal essence, this divine nature, the God within. It's an inner awakening, and then it's an inter-awakening among each other, and then it's an outer awakening, hopefully on the planet. And this is the most crucial existential imperative that any of us faces right now. We must awaken to our interconnectedness where everything is spirit, everything without exception. And so we rest. This morning on my Zen calendar, it said, enlightenment is the ultimate realization that we do not exist as separate beings. And the frightening aspect could be to realize that you are the universe. But then the positive aspect would be, oh my God, I'm the universe. The universe, the one song, the one life. And as that one life awakens within each of us, we create a resonating field, like Rumi spoke about. And when we meet in that field, words are not necessary. That's why the bell is so profound, because we meet in the silence. We meet in the stillness. We meet in the open-hearted awareness that precedes all thought. And then when we look at thought, it's not the enemy, because thoughts think themselves. They just arise from within the tyranny of the little mind. But when we begin to expand our field and know ourselves as the infinite mind, as the we consciousness, then we hear the sound of a phone ringing and we smile, because it's the universe that's calling. And when you realize the universe is calling, you ask then the relevant question, am I listening? And then you stop again and you reflect. And so when an old dog that you've loved so dearly speaks to you on a Sunday morning, and you hold an old teddy bear and you feel the paw of the teddy bear, and somehow you're holding the paw of your old dog, and you say, well, I'm so glad you remember me, because, you know, I remember you. And then you chortle again. There's a show on Netflix, and it's called Dickinson. It's about Emily Dickinson. And she said something just last night. She said, eternity for me is an infinity of now. Eternity for me is an infinity of now. And so when we realize that we're going nowhere, but we actually arrive at now here, spelled the same way, there is an infinity of now here's. And in that now moment, life is pointing the way. It says the outer teacher, and everything is our teacher, takes you to the inner teacher. But the greatest teacher of all is life. And so this Sunday morning, the invitation is to explore this sweet teacher that's everywhere, presenting herself to us, the humble student of truth, so that we might smile again and be blown away with the mystery of belonging to the universe. When you're ready to play in that field of the unmanifest, I invite you to open your eyes, to enter into the sacred moment, and to look at your own self around this room. You know, I feel so much love when I look out at you guys. I don't know what that's all about. Maybe I'm looking at myself out here. And isn't that amazing when you realize everything is you, and when you fall in love with yourself, and that's not an egoic thing, you're falling in love with the self, the big S, then everything is an aspect of that self. Every time I drive to church on Sunday, I think of Jody because the squirrels seem to be darting out from everywhere, and I miraculously miss them all the time. There's that rare occasion where I don't, and then I beat myself up because I haven't been as vigilant as possible. And, you know, someone reminded me, I think it was Emily, she said that she witnessed an accident right in front of her. And by her not pulling out when the light turned green, she wasn't involved in that accident. That happened to me one time on Governor's Drive. The light turned green, I was going to head out, and a car went through the red. And I thought, oh, there but for the grace of God, I would have been the squirrel in the path of a car. Yesterday on a train, I go for walks in the graveyard with the pug, and he rides in his little buggy. It says no dogs allowed, but we feel a little stroller doesn't count. So we go over on Saturday mornings, and he went to turn in to Maple Hill Cemetery, and just as he was getting ready to turn in, a car revved his engine, sped right by the left, must have gone 80 miles an hour, and had we turned in, I wouldn't be sitting here before you. Now, you have those little moments in life, and I think they're wake-up moments. To be so conscious, to be so grateful, to not take one instant for granted that we're sitting here, that we're breathing, that we're alive, and that life is here to show us so much. When I was a brand new minister in 1989, they give you a little manual. They do that for everything, I think. And it said, a minister is first and foremost a student of truth. Now, in the 32-3 years that I've been doing this thing, to stay as a student of truth means to be teachable, means to keep the beginner's mind, means to not hoard the idea that I have the answers. And when you live in the I don't know place, well, then there is this incredible discovery process that's always fresh, that's always alive. You know, Howard Thurman this week, I read something of his. He says, don't seek out how you're going to change the world. Howard Thurman says, find what brings you alive in there and then follow that. So what if instead of having goals, my beloved Ashley, we find out what brings us alive in here and that motivates our doing? Now, what brings you alive? You know, that's a wonderful question. Is it serving another? Is it like my beloved Adam? He and I kind of resonate with the world as our own self. And so the irony is when the hawk flies overhead, could I know that there are no accidents, there are no mistakes truly in the universe, and that it is there to show me something? We started this wonderful class on Wednesday mornings from my favorite book, I think, and Raoul and I share the same love for this teacher. His name is Richard Rohr. And he wrote a little tiny book called Just This. And it's like only 4 chapters long, but it's the simplicity that God is everywhere showing herself to us. And in the very introduction, he says, and to realize, now don't take this personally, but Richard Rohr says, when I know that the only problem that I have is me, well, then I'm halfway there. Now, how many want to know that the only problem you have is yourself? And that's not a finger in the face. That's a recognition that we're programmed, we have conditioning, we have resistance and expectations and attachments. And when we operate from that mental mindset, we get trapped in our own, whatever, reactive nature. And the potential is to set yourself free. So Richard Rohr, in this lovely book, he talks about these patterns. And he went on to write another big book called Sacred Patterns Throughout Creation. And when you see yourself in these patterns, play with it. I mean, Jesus said you have to be like a child if you would enter the kingdom of heaven. What that says to me is we have to be curious and fascinated. What is it showing me? You know, my beloved Joshua's seeing some emotional things arise. Isn't that great? You're aware of it. You know, the olden day, it was Pema Chodron that says, when you put the armor on to protect yourself, what you're doing is you're creating a shield that keeps all that pain in. So when that little boy or that little girl wants to come up in that vulnerable side, could we be compassionate enough to allow that to surface so that we might see what are they trying to show us? So there's this imprisoned splendor that wants to arise. And you know, the irony is that the teacher is within. So could we be willing to listen? So first and foremost, a student of truth. The word educate comes from the Latin word, angor, which is educare. And educare means to draw out. So if we are to be teachable, we have to be willing to let that truth be drawn out of us that is right there within us. Nobody has the answer for you. Nobody is here to fix you or give you the answers. It has to be an inner realization, an awakening. So this month of November, we're talking about how not to go back to sleep. Now, the world would like to medicate you with their belief systems. Here, you just believe this, you stay in this mindset, this belief system. A lot of the churches are there. But when you step out of the churches, when you step out of the conditioned mindset, and you enter into this field of the mystery, well, then the mystery starts to present itself to you in ways you can't even imagine. I've been trying to watch healthy things on television because there's so much that upsets me. And the other, after our Wednesday night live, I went to PBS and they had a thing on Nova about the planet. And sometimes I don't like to watch that because you see animals being killed and the diminished things, and it kind of hurts my heart. But this one was about the termites in Africa and how they built these great big mounds. You need to put your mask on, lovely Serena. Big mounds of termites in Africa. And the elephants need those termite holes to get the dust to cover them up so they don't get burnt by the sun. So you see big elephant sitting on the termite hole and she's wiggling her little fanny around. She weighs this down. Then the little baby elephant comes and you see all this interconnectedness, and then they create this sinkhole where the water fills it and it feeds all the other animals. And you're realizing in this thing on Nova, everything is interconnected. Everything is a part of the divine order. Everything needs each other. And I found myself feeling so alive in this interconnectedness with life. It was actually a happy thing. And then right after that, at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, whatever it was, they showed a thing on the galaxies. Now, I didn't realize, you know, they say Pachimama is our mother, this earth is our mother, but Pachipapa, the universe, is our father. Now, play with that. You're not just a skin-encapsulated ego, a bunch of bones with some skin stretched over it. You're a universal being, and the universe, the father out there, and the mother here, and then play with that awareness. So they showed how our planet is so insignificant on this galaxy in the universe, and how the Andromeda galaxy is coming to meet the Milky Way, and that they're going to collide, and that all these things are going to happen in the universe. Well, they took this little mindset of David Leonard out of the whole complete equation, and I realized I'm part of the universe. Now, is something that vast, something that grand, something that's here for us, could that teach us? What is there to learn? You know, we grew up in a system where we had goals and ideals. We wanted people's approval. Starts with your parents, then it's with your teachers. Then you want to succeed, and you want to graduate from high school with honors. And then you want to get a scholarship to college. I got all those things. Then you get a degree. Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude, meant nothing, because I hadn't found out what brought me alive in here. So I had all the goals, but the goals were an egoic way of finding the world's approval, when there was something deep within that was seeking to awaken. Now, what if that's true for all of us? Just by a simply lowly listening, what is it that wants to awaken in us that is the divine nature that wants to serve, to give and receive love? And what? How could that manifest? And then when something as simple as a dog comes into your life, or a cat, or it could be a squirrel that fell out of the tree in my neighbor's case, and they took the baby squirrel and they raised it like their own child. What if those things have the potential to awaken this divine love within us, so that we might be a part of the evolution of consciousness that's needed on the planet? And then the teachers find you. There's a wonderful saying, and I found it to be very true. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. And the teacher could be anything. The teacher could be the one that pushes your buttons the most. Oftentimes, those that really push the buttons are some of the greatest teachers we have. In relationships, we've all been through relationships. Anybody have any relationships that didn't work out? Am I the only one? And did you find out that in those relationships that, in a way, they were some of your greatest teachers? Because they showed how you had projections onto them, you had attachments onto them, and it was never about them. It was about your attachment or your projection. And when it ended, when it was over, it set you free to really love yourself at a higher level. So then you begin to see the teacher as not just a feel-good person who gives you that great gift, but someone who actually rattles your cages. So back to Richard Rohr. He talks about these three patterns, and I want to play with this absolutely forever because they repeat it again and again and again. The first part of the dynamic pattern is there's a sense of order. There's a belief system. There's a thesis. Then the second thing comes, there's a disorder. There's chaos. There's a breaking up of that belief system. But then the sacred part then is there is a reordering. There's a new way of seeing it. And last week I talked to you about this wonderful book called A New Republic of the Heart by a man named Terry Patton who made his transition a week ago Saturday. And I didn't know about him, but he was a teacher that was seeking me. And I found him through an interview on YouTube. And he's all about the evolution of consciousness and how it's our job to evolve as a species, that there's an imperative. And he talks about we're being in a critical crisis right now on the planet. And we all know that. The climate thing, even that thing about the galaxies. We are a fragile planet, and we have got to awaken as this human species to do what is correct so that we may all survive. And it's much more than just the environment. It's how we treat one another. It's how we treat different people of different races. The poor trans community, they're so condemned in so many states. Could we be big enough to embrace all of our brothers and sisters on this planet? So let me just give you just a taste at the very beginning what the imperative is from this new order of being. He said we're in a holistic crisis. And what we need now are evolutionary eyes. Come on in. We need evolutionary eyes so we can notice how a nuanced, integral perspective can reveal the hidden patterns, there's that word again, patterns, behind our minds, behind our subcultures, behind our cultural wars, and our inspiring evolutionary opportunities. It's a simple idea, evolve or die. Now, I don't mean to say this in a shocking sort of way, but maybe I do. We have to evolve as a species to recognize that we are connected to the universe, we're connected to each other, and somehow we're here to serve something greater than ourselves. It's never been about me, it's never been about you, it's about this, the gestalt of it all. We're all part of this bigger something. And so this beautiful man, through community, this is how they work in this new republic of the heart. They meet in communities like this. They call them circles, and they speak from the heart. And in the speaking from the heart, what happens, and we had it happen in our revealing service, the teacher appears for all of us because the one life starts to express. Maybe tears start to fall. And by our willingness to face what is arising, we create a field of an awakening. We literally hear, you're all my teachers, every single one of you. And usually when the one really is falling down, you teach me the highest because you help me go down into your pain so we can both be in the pain together. It's not about my pain or your pain. It's the pain. It's the pain of giving birth. And Lynn Twist calls it collaborating. She says we are co-laboring. We are all giving birth to this new order of being. And he's saying the same thing. And he said, we must recognize that the whole of our life is our practice. That we're in this crisis. He says, ultimately, we must have an intimate, holistic activism and a dialogue from the we space. There's that we space again, Sylvia. The we space. And the future of friendships into becoming kinds of spiritual friendships, the kinds of sanghas that might evolve the next Buddha. The Buddha isn't the man who lived 2,000 years ago. The Buddha is an awakened consciousness that we all share. And when this awakened presence awakens within us, it contagions each other. The Buddha in me sees the Buddha in you. Just like the jerk in me would see the jerk in you. So what if life is a reflection of who we are? And when I discover that awakened part of me, I can literally see it in Raul. From the very first moment I met him, I realized he was my soul brother. He was speaking Bruce Lipton of the biology of belief and how we get trapped in belief. And belief is causative. You know, it's done unto you as you believe, Jesus said. You know? So what if we could ruthlessly take a look at the beliefs that we've been holding? And is that true? Is that really true? And you realize that much of what we believed is fakakta. It doesn't make any sense. You're raised with it as a small child to believe that you're born in sin. That's the first biggie. And that you need the blood of the lamb to save you. It's all a belief. And when that belief falls away, well, then what are you left with? Well, I guess you consider the idea that you're born innocent. You're not born with sin. Huh. Do you need to be saved? Well, no, you don't need to be saved because you've never been lost. So then the whole belief system falls away. There's that order. It falls away. And you're in this wasteland, this chaos. What's next? And then we get to have a reordering. You walk into a religious science center in 1982, and you're hearing a message that's coming awake within your heart. It's not that I'm being taught something. I'm being revealed that there's something awakening within me. Could I be humble enough to start listening to that awakening process? And it's always going on. Huh. So the outer teacher takes you to the inner teacher, and the greatest teacher is life. Let me get a teeny bit more of this guy. He says, there is a never-ending cooperative adventure in becoming the ones that we have been waiting for. The Hopis had a prophecy, this wonderful, mystical, indigenous tribe in the West. And their prophecy was, is that there is a river. We'll call it the River of Life. And there are those that are floating down this river. They say it's very important. Remember, it's a metaphor. It's a prophecy to keep your head above water and to keep moving forward. And it says, notice who's in the river with you. I would say y'all are in the river with me. Notice who's standing on the shore, holding onto their belief system. They say it's very important at this time in our evolution to not take anything personally. If you take anything personally, there's way too much of you invested in it, and it's never been about you. So not to take anything personally, to keep your head above water, look forward, and above all, because you are the ones that we've been waiting for. So could we humbly know that we are this evolutionary species? It happens right here in Huntsville, Alabama, and it requires that we let go of the order that we were raised with. We're comfortable enough to step into the chaos and then invite this reordering, this rebirth, this new sense of self that wants to arise within each one of us. Could we be there for that? Even though it may be uncomfortable. So he goes on to say this, the intelligence of the heart cannot be asked to wait any longer. It's not about the science of mind. It's about the science of mind and heart coming together. There's another prophecy of the Baha'i that says the eagle and the condor must fly together. The eagle represents the male, the masculine, the mental. The condor represents the intuitive, the female. And when they fly together, then we're a whole balanced person. He's saying the same thing. The intelligence of the heart cannot wait any longer. It must now reclaim the whole human world if we are to survive as a species. And he says, this is the pattern called integral revolution, where we're integrated. You know, and it starts with you in your own personal life. You know, waking up, this Buddha, this awakened self awakens, but then you have to wake in. And waking in, you meet all those toxic patterns, all the shame and the guilt and the shoulds of life. And I'm not good enough. I've made a mistake. They don't approve of me. We've got to heal all that stuff. And the way you heal it is by embracing every aspect of your being, embracing the shadow. There's Carl Jung. And then when you awaken out, well, you realize the outer isn't outer. The outer is you. It's all you. And then you see yourself everywhere. You see yourself in your dog as he curls up in bed and looks at you. You see the spirit of Pumphrey and Bert. They're everywhere around. So he says, this is the integral revolution, a process of growing into a new structure and stage of human evolution that's both necessary and it's unavoidable. You're not going to escape this life experience. So you might as well embrace it. It is what it is. We're here to consciously evolve. There was a time when we changed our name from religious science, and I chose a name called the Center for Conscious Living. It was about living consciously. But then the powers that be decided to call it Centers for Spiritual Living. I think it was more spiritual. But you know, you can be spiritual as all get out, but if you're not conscious, there's no hope for you. Anyway, just say it. It's necessary and it's unavoidable. Whether our future is a great hospice project. Now, you know what that means, to hospice the old. We're going to bury that old way of thinking, hospice the old, or it's also a great process of bringing wisdom to a new cycle of technological, social, and economic innovation, and it needs our highest heart intelligence. I can't wait to get an electric car someday when they have those charging stations, so I don't have to worry about the carbon emissions. I mean, it's just a small thing. I recycle. Anybody recycle here? I have compost heaps. Anybody have a compost heap? You know, you feel you're doing something right when the eggshells go in the compost heap and you put your paper out in your recycle bin. It makes me feel good about myself. Okay, he says, it needs the highest heart intelligence, this evolution. And that must be enacted in every heart, in every relationship, in every organization, and in every fiber of the body politic. We must have politicians who have a heart, who consider what is right for all people, who consider what's right for the planet, who can speak a language of the we consciousness. It's got to be a winner for all. Stephen Covey wrote a book called The Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, and we use it to teach our ministerial students. And the first one that I loved is it always has to be a win-win. It has to be a win for all of us. It can't be just a win for some people. It has to be a win for the environment, you know, a win for the trees. I love the Subaru ads on the television because they never talk about their car. They talk about saving dogs, and now they're talking about planting trees, you know. And if there's any reason to buy a Subaru, it's just because they have their heart in the right place. Now, is that too crazy to think that an automobile company wouldn't be talking profits? They'd be talking about how can we plant more trees and save more animals. You know, there's something sweet about that. So that's a new republic of the heart. Now, the invitation for all of us is to really get ruthfully honest with ourselves. What brings me alive? And the invitation for this Sunday, if you should choose to take this invitation, is to ask yourself, who are the sweet teachers in your life? And you know, they come from the strangest places. Trey and I went to the Georgia Conservancy. We've always been conservationists. And we were living in Georgia at the time, and there was a speaker from the hills of North Carolina. He was a country man, and he said basically, now this was a teacher, I never knew his name, but he says, all we're here to do is to create our own island of decency. And I realized in that holy now moment, he was right, to create your island of decency. You know, Barbara Rowland has this beautiful farm, and in previous days when weren't wearing masks, we would go down there every Thanksgiving and every Easter. And I remember the first day we had just gotten Bert, he was brand new, and we had baby Speck. She was a handful, like that dog you're dealing with, Sylvia. She had all this energy, but you bring an old, calm dog to a neurotic dog, and you know what? The neurotic dog can trade yourself to the calm dog. So Barbara, in her open-hearted awareness, says, oh, bring them down to the farm. They'll have a gay old time. So we drove down to that farm on Thanksgiving, and we opened the door, and they were young. Bert went charging out, and Speck went charging out, and they ran down to the pasture, and Bert picked up one of her chickens in his mouth. And I'm screaming, Bert, drop it, drop it, drop it. Well, he dropped the chicken ran away, and then I became the controlling, neurotic parent. I put them in the car, I closed the car. They no longer had the run of the field. But what if you learn through those little moments, and they're great teaching moments, you know? And then, you know, I think back on the teachers I've had. I've had so many wonderful teachers. And my teacher, Kennedy Schultz, was the teacher that brought me into this teaching. And he was kind of an abusive teacher. And so he taught me in a strange sort of way how not to be. Because sometimes we teach through their example. And I remember as a brand new minister sitting in the old place on L&N Drive, I had one of those really old computers, and on the computer screen was a quote from Admiral Rickover. And Admiral Rickover says, you don't have to make all the problems in your life. You can learn from others and their problems. And I realized as a brand new minister, I didn't have to make all these problems. I could watch outside where others were struggling and choose not to follow their example. So what if the teachers come in a myriad of forms if we have but eyes to see and ears to hear, and that it's all a teacher? And you know, I love the sweet teachers. The four-leggeds are such amazing teachers. They really are. You know, we think we're here to take care of them. Well, really, they're here to take care of us. I remember Reva Walker, if you're listening out there, when Reva's friend died, he had these little dachshunds, and Reva thought she didn't have the time, skill, or finances to take care of them. And I said, well, with all due respect, Raven, they're going to take care of you. And all these years, she realized that I was correct. They're taking care of her, just like she's taking care of them. So what if it's a reciprocal thing? When baby Speck died, and I was kind of grief-stricken because it happened all of a sudden, she had cancer of the jaw. They said, we can either cut off half of her face or we can euthanize her. So Trey put her down. And I was in Canada at the time, and I was really grieving her loss. And someone gave me a book called Soul Contracts, and it was very helpful. They said every animal that we encounter, whether it's domestic or wild, is here without exception to teach us unconditional love. So that hawk was there to teach you. And just like the pileated was there to show me something, or the spider is there to show me something. And so when I realized that, and they said even in death, they're still there for their human. So I began to start having a relationship with these animals that never died. And what's so amazing, as I was thinking about how sweet they were as the teachers, Baby Speck taught me, it's wonderful to be a wild, free spirit, Sylvia. You're not meant to be in control. They had at the Pioneer Park, the Veterans Park, on Veterans Day, they were celebrating. They had the band and everything, and they were standing out, and the music and the flags. And Baby Speck was maybe a year old, and she got off the leash, and she started running in circles around the whole thing. And everybody's looking, who's the parent of that dog? She's running in circles and circles and in circles, and then she sat at our feet and said, I did it, in front of everybody. And I said, you know, you go, baby girl. So then we took her to obedience school, Sylvia, thinking we're going to knock that out of her. And so we took her to obedience school, and they were like little Nazis. They were click the finger, sit, click the finger, come, you know, rigid, rigid, rigid. And so she's Baby Speck with spontaneity is in her blood, kind of like Serena Sage. So the rule was, you tell your dog to sit. You walk to the, it's not about training the dog, it's about training the human. You tell your dog to sit, and then you walk to the other end of this auditorium, and then you turn, and you say, come. And if you have an obedient dog, she comes. So when I walked to the end of the room, she sat there perfectly, just like a little girl would. And I said, come, Baby Speck. She ran in circles. She ran in circles. She ran in circles. And after the third circle, she sat and she said, there. Now, what a teacher is that? She wasn't meant to be molded and conformed into something else. And then when I brought Bird into the thing, well, you know, she had so much energy and she fell madly in love. I mean, he's kind of like a Casanova. He was so beautiful, still is. Well, you know, I am a handsome dog. And he came in there, and she just fell madly in love with him. And they played and played, and they fell into each other's arms. And we realized we made the right decision. And then she would come down in the morning, and she would sit in the chair. He was always a chair dog. And he would sit in the chair, and she'd sit at the bottom of the chair, and he'd lick her ears. Then she'd turn and he'd lick her other ear. Then he'd lick her eyes. And then she'd rotate around and he would groom her and clean her. Now, is that an expression of love or what? Or is it just devotion? Now that Baby Speck is gone, little Humphrey the pug, who has B.O., pugs have B.O., I don't know why that is, the pug would sit down in front of Bert. Well, you know, so he would clean the face and the creases on the one side, and then he'd clean the other side. Then he'd clean the ear, and then he'd clean the ear, and then Humphrey would rotate around. He'd clean under the armpits, and then he'd clean him down, and, well, that's my job, is to do the... What a sweet, sweet teacher. And then even at the very end, when he was so diminished, I mean, it was such a privilege to just help him up the steps. And to walk him around the yard. And he would see the neighbor, and he was such a friendly guy. And he tried to get up his little prance. He was known as a prancer. He couldn't prance at the end, but he could waddle over there. And you know, he taught me patience. He taught me acceptance. He taught me, even in the diminished moments of life, that it can be so, so sacred. So what if the teacher's not what we think it is? It's something so much bigger. I want to close with a little, the teacher of the garden. And The Gardener, this is a book written by a Spanish man. It was translated into English. It was given to me by Mary Ellen Edgar years and years ago. And it's the wisdom of a gardener. And he talks to his young student. I guess that would be all y'all. And the young student wanted to know what life was all about. And so he talked to the young student about finding this inner teacher. And he called the inner teacher divine love. So here's how The Gardener says it. And then we'll go into a meditation. And Raul can go to the bell. If he would like to. Okay. He says, you have to wish for the change within yourself, he's saying to the young man, and be open so that the transformation takes place within you. We have to be willing to be renewed by the restored by the renewing of our mind. And if you try to provoke it, if you're trying to grab at it, Adam, it's not going to happen. Then a conflict will begin in your heart, and it will leave you wounded and hurt. You can't make this evolution happen. You can open to it and allow it. So he says, simply open your heart. Let the transformation take place when life considers it the right moment for you. When conditions are right, the Buddha says, things manifest. So is this the time for you to flower in your heart space? Is this the time for you to enter into the mystery of belonging to the universe? Is this the time for love to awaken? What brings you alive? Just ask that question. He's asking the young man to do this. He said, the bird isn't shown how it should fly. Nobody explains to the fish how it must swim.
clearly. One day they throw themselves into the wind or into the sea, and their own divine nature does the rest. Something within you knows how to live the life that you've been given. So could we surrender to that in a moment of awe? Then he goes on to say, to love is written in human nature. It is a love as big as the ocean, a love that covers everything and everyone. Humanity has only to throw themselves into the tide of life with an open heart, and an open nature will do the rest. It is love that will bring about the transformation in your soul. This is the gardener speaking to his apprentice. It is the love that will bring about the transformation in your soul, and with it will come the transformation of the world. The whole world exists within you. And when you awaken to your divine nature, the world is awakening to its divine nature. It's not changing the world, it's changing who you are. He goes on to say, and absorbed in his thoughts and his heart space, the gardener finished by saying in a very quiet voice to the young person, when a human being finds love and reveals that love, then the whole universe shudders in its splendor. When this love awakens within you, the whole universe shudders with its splendor. So I invite you in this moment, Raul, you want to give us a ring of the bell? To return to where we began. For whom the bell tolls, says Hemingway. The bell tolls for thee. And it's taking us into that spacious place where the wisdom of the heart can awaken. A heart that knows only love. A heart that knows oneness. A heart that by its very nature is peaceful and compassionate. And we rest as that. It is our capacity to experience this precious, precious commodity called divine love that awakens the love within the world. And so when the capacity is there for a squirrel in the street or a spider in the web or the capacity to smile at a stranger, knowing that you're smiling at your own self, that there's only one life here and it's awakening. And we come here to stay awake to the potential and the possibility and the consequence of what it would be to be on this planet as an awakened Buddha consciousness, as a bodhisattva, one who serves the awakening in all. It is not about me or you awakening, it's about the awakening of humanity to its spiritual magnificence. And then the evolution of consciousness arises out of that. And out of that evolution, then the world begins to shift and there's a new order of being. We had to go through this chaos in order for this rebirth to happen. So I invite you to reflect on what we need to hospice in your world, what needs to die. It's a beautiful line in scripture that says, die daily to be born again in me, in this presence. And so as we invite death as a part of life, well then maybe what needs to die is reaction, judgment, concern, fear, worry. You can give a whole list of things that need to perhaps die. And then what awakens? What has given birth? Hope. A deep acceptance of what is. And then we invite the teachers, the sweet, sweet teachers, as they come into our orbit of concern. And we listen. In oneself lies the whole world. And if you know how to look and to learn, then the door's there and the key is in your hand. But no one gives us this key or the door to open except ourselves. And so as we show up here consciously on Sunday mornings, we are making a commitment to allow ourselves to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, to
awaken the wisdom of the heart that knows oneness, and to step out of our local consciousness into the we consciousness, so that we might see things with different eyes. And then life begins to flower. Like the gardener said, it just begins to unfold with grace and ease, and we shudder at the magnificence of what awaits. It is Emerson that said, only the coming is sacred. We let the past go, and we embrace this emergent evolution as our destiny, as the destiny of the human species. I invite you to place your hand on your heart space, and let's say to this transformational process within and all around, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the awakening of the universe within my heart. The beloved presence in me bows to the beloved presence in you. In this spacious awake awareness, we are one. Our life unfolds with ease and grace. As we say yes, a thousand times yes. And we invite the revelations. Open your eyes, open your hands, open your hearts. Step into the now moment. Eternity is an infinity of nows. And this is the moment the Lord has made, so rejoice and be glad in it. It is done. Feel it, smile to it, and you're it. You're the ones we've been waiting for. Thanks for sending in your tithes out there in virtual land. Thanks for showing up on Wednesday night, Wednesday class, and be safe. And enjoy this beautiful weather.
Listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.